The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. On the eve of the Euros, who will Gareth go for on Sunday? All the players seem so relaxed. They play darts, they sing songs. All of those telltale signs of a winning team. It's coming together. And then you hear they're checking if Luke Shaw can play centre-back. Panic. Everybody panic. COVID in the Spain camp. We'll get the Sid lowdown on that. We'll get sensible predictions for the tournament from Mark Langdon. We'll get predictions from Jordan Jarrett-Bryan. Paulo Fonseca to Spurs. Is that good or bad? Or a seventh place manager for a seventh place team? Everton want Benitez. That's fun. The ESL 6 are forced to rustle up just over £3 million each for trying to decimate the entire football pyramid. That sounds fair. We, of course, have your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan. I'm sorry, that was rude of me, wasn't it?
It was rude, but possibly true, to be fair. So I'll give you that one. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark Langdon from the Racing Post.
Hi, Max.
A compatriot writes, how does Mark Langdon feel about being on the pod with a legume, with Marcus Bean? Is that okay, Mark?
It's not the first time. Yeah. As long as I don't have to eat, Marcus, we're all good.
See, the Cannibalism Weekly is a new format we're trying out next year. Marcus Bean, hello, mate.
Hi, mate. You're right.
Good. Oh, and congratulations to Brentford, Marcus.
Amazing. Yeah. What a day.
How was it?
No, it was an amazing day. Relatively comfortable, if I'm honest. Thinking I'd be a little bit more nervous watching it, but the boys were excellent, and then the after party was just as good as well. So it was a great day.
Okay. And we interviewed Rasmus Ankersen, is that his name, the director of football?
Yeah.
And we asked him, he said Thomas Frank was going to get very drunk. We said, how drunk? He went, oh yeah, he really got drunk.
He was. He led the celebrations, to be fair. He's a great, great character, infectious character.
Yeah. That's good. Anyway, the Euros start tomorrow night. Turkey, Italy, great game to start with. We'll be doing pods all through the Euros after the full-time whistle, presumably published in time for the morning for you in the UK. Let's begin, though, with the England game on Sunday. A new panel, another chance to pick our England team. Let's go through the cliched questions. And I guess before we work out what team Gareth Southgate is going to pick, we have to work out what formation he's going to pick. Reading today, Mark, that he's trying Luke Shaw on the left of a three, which I don't hate. I mean, I wouldn't mind if he'd done it before, but do we think that means it's going to be a three?
I would have thought so. Because, well, I don't think you'd want Luke Shaw in a back four playing left side of the centre backs. That's for certain. I think the fact that Ben White was brought in as well to be the replacement for Alexander Arnold was maybe another nod in that direction towards a back three. And I also think that, you know, Harry Maguire, if he's not fit, the back four would worry me. I think if it was Mings and Stones together, so I think sort of safety in numbers might be the better approach. But I agree with you. It would have been nice, I think, to have at some stage during this couple of friendlies to have at least seen, I think, what the plan was supposed to be, because most of the national teams have put out at least 9 or 10 of their players, and it's usually the done thing, isn't it? You know, maybe the game before, to just get your pattern of plays working, and we still don't know if it's a back four or a back three, and I think that is a slight concern. Yeah.
Jonathan Wilson wrote a piece in the paper today saying, look, it's good to be boring. He said it on this pod as well. I think he was just talking about himself, but, you know, talking about tournament football, and that, you know, the last team really to win a tournament playing really progressive attacking football was probably Spain in 2012. In which case, do you think a three is the right thing to do, Marcus?
I think with the personnel that he's got and the injury problems he's had, it's the right thing to do. I think playing Luke Shaw left side of a three will be fine, and he's got the legs. Bit of an issue with the height. Obviously, you've lost another taller player there. But I think a three is a good formation. It suits the personnel that we've got as well.
Okay. I don't know what it says about Tyrone Mings, his form. You're looking confused, Jordan.
Only confusing as far as I find it interesting that we just accept that if you don't have good defenders, the answer is to have another defender. I just don't buy this idea that having three at the back makes you defensively better. If you've got not good defenders, and I don't think England do have good centre defenders, just throwing another body in there doesn't necessarily mean you're defensively more sound. I think that we need to try and think of other more nuanced ways to getting around the conundrum of not having good defenders, but still having a team in a shape that I think can not be impacted up top. I personally would still go over back four, even without Harry Maguire, because I think the gap between Harry Maguire and the others isn't as big as everyone makes it out. I don't think Harry Maguire is as good as everyone says he is. So I think there's more of a system that should be maybe four at the back, and then maybe having two, like a Bellingham and a Rice, like together, and a Mount in front of that, and then a front three. So I don't always understand why we just accept that a back three. I always think psychologically for the opposition, if you see a team setting up with three at the back, that, I mean, Marcus will know more than me here, but does that not make you think, well, they're scared? They're scared. So from the get-go, you're thinking, well, they're scared. They're overcompensating. We've mentally kind of got a bit of a one up there. I might be talking rubbish, Marcus. Tell me.
No. I think by playing a three at the back, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a necessarily more defensive formation. I think if you're utilising your wing-backs, playing really attacking, that we've seen at Sheffield United, the left side centre-half or right side centre-half could drive out with the ball. You know, these are all things. I think the issue is, do you trust Tyrone Mings in a four? For me, I think White's better than Tyrone Mings personally. I think I'd put White ahead of Tyrone Mings, but do you trust him in a four? He's going to be isolated at times. Do you trust him to make the right decisions? He's got a moment of madness in him that I've seen, and which I'm not very sure about. I think you could still be very attacking in a three. I don't think it's necessarily a defensive formation. It's just about protecting certain players and not playing certain players that you're not too sure on.
I mean, the issue with playing three at the back, Mark, is we can't get all the attackers in that we really want to all get in. You know, as soon as the team sheet comes out, even in a four, someone's going to go, but hang on, Foden isn't playing, or Grealish isn't playing, or Rashford isn't playing, or Sterling isn't playing. And so if you play a three, then what, you're playing a three with, you know, who's missing there? Like, how does it work in front of them in terms of the midfield and the attack?
I think a lot will depend on, I suppose, Henderson's fitness. I mean, if he's available for the first game, you would assume he would play. I mean, he's got 45 minutes in his legs from the friendly. So it would be, I would personally go for Bellingham. I think last time I was on, sort of around that mark time, I was saying Bellingham and Rice feels like a good combination, particularly if Henderson isn't fit. In terms of who misses out, I mean, it is a tough one. I mean, I maybe wouldn't start Grealish, and I know that everyone's getting really excited about Jack Grealish, and rightly so. But I think we've also got to be a little bit careful with him. He's only just come back from injury, and I would still rather have maybe Foden, and if it's going to be like Foden Mount or Foden Mount and one of those wider players, whether it's Sancho or Rashford or Sterling, I don't think there's a massive difference between a lot of them. And that's why Southgate is going to have an issue if, say, England go out or lose a game early on, because you, for exactly what you just said there, Max, it will be, why didn't you pick A, B or C? And that's going to happen to Gareth Southgate, no matter who he picks. If he picks Grealish and Foden, people will go, well, you know, where's the pace alongside Kane? If he doesn't pick Grealish, how can you leave Grealish out? How can you leave Mount out? That's just the issue that Southgate's got. It's a really difficult one for him, but it's much better than not having those players and, you know, scrambling around for an 11.
Where does Mason Mount in a 3-4-3 or 3-5-2? We're not going to play two centre forwards, are we? So Mount is a 10 and is at his best in a 10. So, and Southgate always starts Mount, and Mount has been brilliant, but he doesn't naturally fit one of those wide players that Grealish, Foden, Rashford, Sterling, Sancho do.
Yeah, but Chelsea play that kind of with two tens in sort of a 3-4-3, and Mount and Havertz would maybe be the two off of Werner, or, you know, it does move around a little bit. So in that kind of Chelsea formation, it would probably be Foden and Mount, I would assume, sort of off of Harry Kane, and then you've got your five substitutions, and I think that the subs are going to be massively important at this Euros because of how tired everybody is, and the use of those subs. I think he's going to maybe be more important than in previous tournaments.
It's almost incredible that we're going into a tournament thinking that Sancho, Rashford and Sterling might not start. I think at the start of the season, at least one or two of them were nailed on. So I'll find it very difficult. And I agree. I like that formation, the kind of box in midfield with two sitting and two just ahead as tens, whoever that may be. But I can't see Southgate losing all three of those out. So I think one of them will start.
I agree with both Mark and Marcus. I've just got to go back to Jonathan's point about being boring. I agree with him. I think there's this obsession we have, and I get it, we're football fans, we want England to score 20 goals and excite. But I think we have to understand that teams that generally win these competitions are defensively sound first, with strikers that can score goals when they get chances. I think that Southgate's natural inclination is to be more conservative. And I get that. I understand that. But we're also underestimating, I think, this group. I think England will get out of this group. I think England will top this group. But it wouldn't be a massive surprise if they came third. England could draw that first game against Croatia. You then go into a big game against Scotland, who are going to be doubly up for it. If that goes wrong, this could go really badly wrong for England. So I think him trying to get into the first game and just not lose that first game, I think is important. And just finally, on this Jack Grealish thing, I'm so with Mark. I'm so bored of everybody talking about Grealish having to start. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. Jack Grealish is a very, very, very good player. He's not Lionel Messi. When I hear people talking about play Jack Grealish and build the team around him, no. He's not that good. And I don't think it's any bad thing having someone like Jack Grealish or a Foden come off the bench after 70 minutes. Imagine that. So in my starting 11, Grealish isn't in it. I think in Southgate's 11, he won't be in it as well. But rather than obsessing with who's playing and who's not playing up front, I think the focus needs to be more how we keep clean sheets. And secondly, I think, again, as Mark says, Southgate can't win. Whoever he picks, there'll always be people saying, oh, well, why don't you pick so-and-so? How can you leave out so-and-so? So the focus for me has to be being brave, Southgate committing to a team and just believing in that team and not listening to the naysayers.
Some more Aston Villa.
Well, there's that as well. There's that too.
Actually, it's interesting when you sort of say a three, you know, people say a three is more defensive. If it's Kyle Walker, John Stones and Luke Shaw, I mean, that's actually a sort of bizarrely attacking back three, isn't it? I mean, is that what the three will be? And then if we think Shaw might be on the left, and then you play Chilwell and Reece James or Kieran Trippier, that's a sort of insanely attacking defensive line.
If he goes for that, then totally, yeah. I think that's a little bit maybe too attacking. But I think that the rhetoric has been thus far up until yesterday that it's going to be three defenders or two centre-backs and maybe a Kyle Walker. And this Luke Shaw line coming out yesterday has kind of maybe changed that a little bit.
So what, that would be Cody in the middle with Stones on the right?
You'd think, yeah.
Mark, what do you think?
No, I think Ben White's played his way
in.
I think that Southgate likes Ben White, obviously picked him in the 26, but I think that it happens in tournaments where somebody you, maybe a month ago that wasn't involved suddenly, you know, just bursts onto the scene almost, sort of a bit like how Michael Richards claims that he did. But, you know, he bursts onto the scene and then just forces his way in. And I mean, without digging out Southgate, I think he picked the wrong squad in the first place. I mean, I couldn't believe that Tomori didn't make the 26. And he's somebody that, okay, he hasn't played in the three, but he played on the left side of a two for Milan in the second half of the season and did very well. I would say completely outperformed Mings and Connor Cody. So I think the lack of... he's not being decisive enough at the moment, Southgate, and that concerns me, I think.
Oh, gosh, such a difficult thing to do, isn't it?
And it's not easy. It's not easy.
Well, we don't have to do it, I guess. Luke says, if we win the Euros, England, can we say we kind of contributed? Max, we never played together or against each other, but we were part of the same pyramid system that some of the older players in the squad came through. We helped push the players that were better than us, who helped push the players who were better than them throughout the pyramid system, right the way to the top. So without us and millions of others, you know, Jordan Henderson, would he be as good as he is, for example? Maybe we shouldn't expect to get a medal. But if you look at it like this, we have played our part. I suppose the question is that, you know, if it hadn't been for me, Marcus, you wouldn't have got to the level you got to. And if it hadn't been for you, Jordan Henderson would have got to the level he got to. I suppose if that is the case, if England don't win, we have to take the responsibility too, I suspect. But it's a good point, Luke. Mark, we ended Tuesday's preview pod predicting Portugal would win it somehow. I'm interested to hear your thoughts. I think Nicky went for a rogue Portugal to beat France at one point, if that's a possibility. I forget exactly how we did the thing at the end. But Portugal hammered Israel 4-0 in their last game before the tournament. France beat Bulgaria 3-0. Giroud scoring twice. He's five away from France's all-time goal-scoring record held by Thierry Henry. Benzema got a knock, is apparently okay. Apparently, Mbappe didn't pass it to Giroud. Did anyone see that story? I mean, it's probably nonsense, isn't it? But quite fun. Did you ever have a player you didn't pass to, Marcus? I mean, intentionally?
No, I've never. I was always a team player.
Mark, what do you think? You know, this close to the tour, have you changed your view on favourites and not favourites, etc.?
No, I've been sort of pretty sweet on France really for a while. I think that they are the best team. They're in the hardest group, but the fact that three teams can get out of, you know, some of the groups, I think makes it not such a scary proposition being in with Germany and Portugal. I mean, the back four is almost the same that won the World Cup. Jonathan Wilson was talking about sort of boring teams. I think France are quite dull, really, and could be sort of braver and better on the ball, but they choose not to be. Kimpembe is coming from Titi, the midfield of Pogba and Kante, and one other, probably Tolisso, maybe Rabiot, I think is very well balanced. And then you've got that front three of Benzema, you know, Mbappe and Griezmann, which I think you can sort of defend with six or seven and just let them three, you know, go and win the game. They've got I mentioned earlier on about the benches. I think that it will be important, and Kingsley Coman and Ousmane Dembele, players like that, to come off the bench, I think will, you know, be game changers for France if they need them to be. And I just feel like they're the best balanced team in the competition and will play the kind of conditions best as well. I think Jordan's shaking his head.
Here comes a hot take.
Okay. Oh, well, it's coming. My first big prediction for the Euros actually is I think Portugal are going to bomb. I think they're going to bomb. I think they'll finish third in that group. I think they'll probably, as Mark says, get out of the group. But I think they're going to bomb, and the reason why I think they're going to. There's always a story in the group stage, right? There's always one big team that takes the headlines. I think it'll be them. I think in the same way that Ronaldo was the single biggest reason, or the single reason they won the Euros last time, I think he'll be the single reason why they bomb. Because I think the incessant need to make him the centralised force of everything they do at this championships, I think might backfire. I think they've actually got a better team than France. So I've got a feeling that this need to make Ronaldo the centrepiece of their success will backfire. France, I think the Benzema-Giroud thing, I think Giroud will play a really pivotal role as the competition goes on. I can see him being the selfless player they end up needing rather than the better striker, Benzema, who I think is a bit more selfish. And I think as part of scoring goals, you need to be selfish. But I think Giroud could slowly become the star in the latter parts of this competition.
I like how you said he... No, A, slowly become something, and B, be pivotal as a slow pivot. That's sort of perfect. It's perfect for Giroud. Pirlo did drop Ronaldo a bit. I mean, there's no chance, Mark, is there, of the Portuguese manager dropping Ronaldo?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. No, I mean, it's such a big call to make. I mean, you'd be bringing in... I mean, Andre Silva had a really good season in the Bundesliga and his... You know, a kind of, I suppose, more natural front man, really. I mean, sort of, you know, being that traditional number nine type. They've got somebody like João Felix who could, you know, play in the four positions. But I think Ronaldo is so iconic to the team that to drop him would just be more hassle than it's worth, really, because you then have to win. If you don't win, like, you know, you just play it safer, I think, and put him in the team. I mean, for a sort of hot take, I would go for, I think if there's to be an outrageous winner, I think it'll be Denmark are the most likely ones. I looked at their squad, Christensen and Kjær, I think are really good centre-halves. Kasper Schmeichel, solid goalkeeper. Midfield, Delaney and Højbjerg, you know, you're not going to get past them two very easily. Eriksen is a very capable player, both in terms of scoring from distance or creating a set piece. And then they're not amazing forwards, but somebody like Yusuf Poulsen plays for Leipzig. Braithwaite, he's doesn't play for Barcelona every week, but he's still sort of, you know, in and around that squad. So if there's to be sort of like a complete blowout of all of the big teams, I think Denmark might be the ones to win.
Marcus, who's your money on?
I'm with Mark, and I'm going to go with France. I think the strength and depth is what's going to pull them through. If you look right through their 21s all the way up to the first team, it's just insane the amount of level of talent they've got. So I believe they're going to be the ones to win it.
Ash says, who's your hipster team for the Euros and why? Mine would be Ukraine because they have a player with the surname Popov. The child inside me thought it was hilarious. Come on, Ash. We are the most highbrow of the podcasts. You're better than that. We're all better than that. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Sid Lowe will join us. We'll talk about how Spain are looking in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. There's a live show tonight for the very few of you who listen to this pod before that show starts. theguardian.com/guardianlive if you want a ticket. I'm tweeting on the hour, which is upsetting a lot of people about it. But I schedule the tweets. There's nothing I can do. Alistair says, does Mark plan to do a European Championships of Butter to coincide with the tournament? If so, who wins in the final between Lurpak Spreadable and that French butter with all the nice salt crystals in it? Interesting that he said that. I'm not giving away what happens on tonight's live show, but that's quite prescient, isn't it, Mark?
I saw that tweet and wondered just who'd been sort of snooping, to be honest.
Well, I'm looking forward to that bit of the live show anyway, Mark. So joining us now, Sid Lowe out in Spain. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, very good. COVID will play a part, and it is already happening in, you know, with Spain and with Sweden, who play each other on Monday night. You imagine at some point during the tournament, a team will be sort of decimated by a number of COVID positive tests. But what's the latest from Spain?
Well, the latest from Spain is that the army is turning up today to vaccinate them. Now, I must admit, and forgive my ignorance on this, I'm not sure how this process now works. If the vaccination has some sort of side effects for the first 2 or 3 days, bear in mind that Spain are very close to that game. So it could be that in the very short term, the vaccine is problematic. Obviously, in theory, at least in the long term, it's beneficial. That said, of course, because the vaccine takes a while to work through, and you know, there's been a lot of talk about this, and obviously I'm not an expert on this kind of thing, the suggestion is that the real impact of the vaccine actually won't take hold in those players' bodies until the tournament's over. So it's of a certain value. But this has happened, of course, because there's been a nervousness at the fact that they've had 2 positive tests, and that there's been this kind of sense that, oof, we better get on and do this. There's an interview last night with Jordi Alba. He used this lovely Spanish phrase. He said, yeah, they've done this because they've seen the wolf's ears. In other words, you know, they've seen this dangerous thing rearing interview and thought, bloody hell, we better get on and do this. Spain's reaction to this obviously was fairly dramatic, in a way more dramatic than the reality of the situation, because it's 2 players out of a squad of 24. But the reaction was to immediately take Busquets out. He goes home and quarantines for 10 days. The same then happened with Diego Llorente, who also tested positive, 10 days at home. But the big thing, of course, was this idea that he said, right, okay, we lock everyone down now. We stay at Las Rozas, the training camp, but everyone gets locked down and we do individual training sessions rather than group training sessions. The other thing that's been really interesting in this with Spain is that they've basically built a parallel squad in a separate bubble. They've got a 17-man parallel squad in a separate bubble ready to take over should they need to. Now, obviously, the likelihood is they won't be needed.
The parallel squad tournament would be fun, wouldn't it?
It would be a lot of fun. Well, I mean, they might even be better. I mean, this is partly tongue-in-cheek, but Spain's game against Lithuania this week was obviously due to be their last warm-up game. They couldn't play. One of the decisions they took was, right, we don't play Lithuania. We send the under-21s to play. And the under-21s were brilliant. And so everyone, I'll tell you what, why don't we send them to the Euros instead? The under-21s beat Lithuania 4-0. It's going to be a brilliant pub quiz one day. Pub quiz question. Because that game was officially a senior international. And they, you know, the Federation made a point of confirming this was officially a senior international. So you had 16 debutants. You had 4 debutants scoring. You had 2 debutant goalkeepers keeping clean sheets. You had a manager taking over for one game and then giving up again, which I suppose officially means that Luis Enrique has now had 3 different spells as Spain manager. And in the end, they won 4-0. The last time the full international team played Lithuania, they only won 3-1. So yeah, play the under-21s.
When can the squads train together again? I mean, if they're all doing their own training session, that seems mad before a tournament.
Well, that doesn't help the squad at all. The original plan was, while we wait to see, because obviously there's daily PCRs, right? While we wait to see that we get continuous negative tests, and that would be 4 or 5 days. We haven't actually been given a date for the point at which they do that. As I say, the parallel squad is training together, by the way. The parallel squad in the different bubble is training together, but this squad is 4 or 5 days in theory. Now, obviously, at the very least, they're going to have to do something before they play that first game. Sorry, the dog's just come in, which is what that
point is. That's fine. Hi, Estella. A lot of legacy pod fans get frustrated that we don't talk enough about Estella.
Right, now maybe she'll be calmer. Okay. Sorry, carry on.
She's licking Sid's face. Marcus, a question to you about that individual training thing. I mean, it just sounds like that would be terrible preparation for a tournament. I mean, obviously, you won't have been in a position where suddenly your manager said you're all training on your own. Our squad wouldn't have enough footballs for that. But, like, you know, what do you do?
No, it sounds like, yeah, as you said, a really bad preparation. I think leading up to a tournament, especially in international football, where managers don't have much time with them, they want to be getting really drilling down into the granular detail in terms of tactics, etc. And you can't do that via unless everyone's on the pitch together, going through shape, walking through things. So if Enrique's obviously going to be, you know, pulling his hair out at the moment in terms of, is his team going to be ready for the first match?
I say you could do one of those Sam Allardyce shape things where you're all far apart and you're all just spending, or Roy Hodgson, you're spending hours just standing in position and never getting close to each other. Jordan?
Question for Sid. Sid, I've heard lots of the other Spanish football experts talking about Spain's chances.
There are other ones?
There aren't. Where are these people?
I was going to say, but I'm coming to the main man to ask, is the Spain squad as bad as they're making it out to be? Because whilst up front, they do look a little bit blunt. I looked through the squad, and it's not a vintage squad of the last 10 years, but it feels to me like it's not quite as bad as many experts are making out. Or am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. I think it's not that bad, and I certainly think that the starting 11 is likely to be a very strong one. I think there are one or two kind of blunt points in it. I think what happened in a way was that the focus was taken so much to the absentees, and that kind of created a sense of, well, how can you do this? Obviously, you can read that two ways, because sometimes when there are good players who don't go, you say, oh, well, the squad itself must be amazing. But I think it got drawn to that a little bit. I think as well, obviously, they're victims of how good the previous generation was, and everyone kind of keeps looking at that. But I still think this is a strong squad. I think it's a team that does have that bluntness. I think the other thing is, and this obviously speaks a little bit to the idea of them training individually, all the way through Luis Enrique's time in charge, there's always been this sense of, are we sure what the team is yet? It hasn't been kind of bedded in. There hasn't been, if you like, a kind of a very clear sense of collective functioning, because players who get called up have been called up and then not been called up again. Another player gets called up out of nowhere. So Pablo Sarabia, for example, no one expected it this time round. And then if on top of that, you then haven't got the time to work with them, then in theory, you know, it will be weaker than it should be. I think there are one or two doubts about it. I think there is a doubt in terms of who will score the goal. But look, this is a team that back in, when was it? March, I think, put 6 past Germany. Now, it was a bit of a weird game and it was a bit of a one-off, but it's still a team that put 6 past Germany. Admittedly, it's then a team that went and struggled against Greece.
Sid, just on that bluntness, is there any news yet on who's likely to be the starting striker between Gerard Moreno or Morata or maybe even somebody else?
I think there's a possibility that they both play together. And I think if only one of them plays, I think it would be Morata. Because I think although they are both strikers, they're very different profiles of strikers in terms of the way they play. Moreno is much happier kind of dropping off into a narrow right-sided role just off the forward. He's happier being in those kind of spaces and having people to play off. Morata is the only one of the strikers they've got really that is... You know, I don't want to go into kind of very obvious old cliches, but that is strong, that holds the ball well, that runs beyond people, that's reasonably athletic. It's true that occasionally he lacks that little bit of aggressiveness to go with those physical qualities. But I'd be surprised if it wasn't Morata. And of course, Morata, the other element with this, which has been eclipsed a bit by everything that's happened with the COVID cases, is that in their one friendly they were able to play, Morata misses a chance at the very, very end and has his own fans chanting at him, saying how bad he is. And so, you know, there's kind of an emotional process to be worked through there as well.
Sweden have obviously been hit by COVID as well. They played Spain on Monday. Dejan Kulusevski and Mattias Svanberg are both going to miss that game. Mark, how big a deal is that for them?
I think Kulusevski is a big deal. I mean, he hasn't performed great for Juventus this season because nobody really at Juventus played that well, and it's very difficult for any individual, if you know the collective's broken, to really shine through. But the season before, and what earned him the move to Juve in the first place, was the fact he was the best player, the best young player in Italy, and he offers Sweden something that maybe they haven't got necessarily, just in terms of, I mean, Ishak has come in and is now leading the line, but Kulusevski is somebody that can play in a variety of roles, but he's very quick and can run beyond attackers and sort of really break those defensive lines. And I was looking forward to seeing him play. I hope he'll be able to play some part in the tournament. But Sweden that still play that kind of classic 4-4-2 that's very Sweden, I suppose. And he was just somebody that offered a bit different to what the rest of the team does. And I think they are a solid, functional team. And Ishak will obviously, the Spanish players will know him reasonably well. But Kulusevski was just somebody else that could do that.
Sid, has there been any coverage in Spain of the booing of the taking of the knee from England fans? Or is there any discussion about whether the Spanish team will take the knee or not?
No, well, we've had a few sort of slightly awkward moments this year with games where Spanish teams have played against English ones and genuinely not expected it. So I was at, for example, the Granada-Manchester United game, Villarreal-Arsenal. There's another game, I'm trying to think which one it was, and in which the players from the English teams went down on the knee and the Spanish players kind of looking around thinking, oh, hang on, I'm not sure if they should join in or not, because of course they weren't kind of ready for it. To be honest, it hasn't really been discussed. At least it's not been discussed, if you like, as kind of a mainstream debate. It gets picked up on because foreign football gets covered here and English football is very popular, and so people are very well aware of it. But it's never reached that point at which has been a suggestion that, OK, we should do this too, except for a brief moment after the Juancala Diakabi case when Cadiz played against Valencia. There was a brief moment then about whether Spanish teams should be making some sort of gesture, whether they should be taking it a step further than they are at the moment. And that debate, to be honest, didn't last very long.
We had one or two people getting in touch very politely giving the quote other side of the debate, if there is one, saying you can't just say taking a knee is completely unconnected to the Black Lives Matter movement. Sam sent an interesting message in saying, look, one for the podcast, if you have time, I won tickets to go and see England play Croatia, my first time watching England play. Obviously, this is exciting, but I'm a little worried about what to do during the taking of the knee. Do I stay silent and show respect? Do I cheer in solidarity in the face of the inevitable boos? Would staying silent make me complicit, or is it the safer thing to do? I was wondering what the correct thing to do is. Even as a white man, it's a bit worrying. I wondered, and actually from the first game to the second game, more people applauded and cheered when it happened, and I thought that was an important message. It's very hard to tell if the same number of people were booing or smaller number of people were booing, but booing louder. I don't know, Jordan, what you think.
Well, it's going to be a story that's going to develop throughout the tournament for sure. And I think that the more... Now Southgate has written that open letter to the nation. I think that it's going to aggravate those who don't think we should be connecting politics and football. I think game by game, that tension is going to grow. I mean, my personal view is that I don't have a problem with people who boo in taking the knee. My issue is the lying of the reason why they're booing. That's more my reason. If you want to boo the knee, then that's your prerogative. You're allowed to do that. Just don't give me this rubbish about, we're booing it because taking the knees is linked to defunding the police and all that kind of stuff. I think that I'm interested to see.
So what you're sorry to clarify that.
Yeah.
If people boo it, you want them to say, "I'm booing it because I'm a racist."
Yeah. Basically, just be honest. Just be honest. I think that if you don't understand, if you're refusing to understand and listen to why the Gareth Southgate and the players have told you, they've told you now why they are taking the knee. If you are blatantly and outright going to just say that's not the reason, well, you can't tell me my reasons for doing something. I'm telling you my reasons are. If you discounter that, then you're just being ignorant. I think what's also interesting as well is how we cover the booing of taking the knee during the competition. And by we, I mean The Guardian, myself, Channel 4 News. I think I was disappointed with Sky Sports yesterday, who did an interview with somebody, some fan representative from an England group. And they, as you said, they kind of allowed him to give the opposing view as to why people are allowed to take the view. And he was talking just absolute rubbish. He was contradicting himself and it was just a mess. And I fear that that us covering the booing of taking the knee may embolden and fuel those booing taking the knee further. So I think we have to be very, very careful about how we indeed cover this story, which I think will be a big thing throughout the competition.
We can't not cover it.
No, at all. Not at all.
It is, yeah. But I agree.
But it's how we cover it.
Well, his claim was the communication had been bad. And as far as I can tell, the communication has been very clear from Gareth Southgate and from the players. I wonder what your take is, Marcus.
No, I think Jordan summed it up very well. I think the communication has been very clear. It's indisputable now why they're doing it. So if you boo it, then you're racist. That's just my opinion on it. If you feel that you go to a game and you don't feel like you want to support them, just be quiet. Just be quiet, because ultimately these players are out there representing the country, trying to win a tournament. And if you're an England fan, you should be trying to make sure that they're in the right mindset to perform. And the only way to do that is to be keep quiet or cheer them. That's in my opinion. So that's the way I see it.
And sorry, Mark jumps in, just a quick one as well. England have a good chance of winning the Euros. I don't think they will win the Euros, but they have the squad to do really well here. Combined with the talent that we have, and there are doubts around Southgate and how good he is as a manager, and I get all that. But if we're going to do well for 6 weeks, or was it 4 weeks, if we can come together, I'm going to get all pithy and la-di-da here, but if we can just for 4 weeks come together to support the team and put our politics and put our cultural differences aside for just 4 weeks, I think that that can only help the team. We're hampering the team from the get-go if we are booing the players. Everyone doesn't have to agree with taking the knee, but to actively boo it, you haven't got to applaud it or cheer it, but to actively boo it, think about what you're saying to the players that you're supposedly supporting on that day. And that's one reason that's going to hamper us doing well this competition.
Yeah, I'm a great believer in positive energy and how that can manifest itself. And in all the promotion seasons I've had, there's always been that kind of, not just in the players, but the club as a whole, the staff, the fans, everyone comes together. And if you want to achieve anything in this tournament, also if the England want to achieve anything in this tournament, that has to happen. That includes the press, the fans, the players. You know, everyone's got to get behind them, because players do feed into that and it does affect them. They're only human beings. So when they go out there and they're putting what they see is putting their they're ruling for their country, the minimum they require is that support. So I think everybody just needs to get behind them.
Ian Wright said at the Riverside with the second game that we need to reach the people who are booing. And I'm really aware that, you know, I tick every box for middle class, woke, snowflake, lefty, you know, all those things. I am not the person that they will not listen to me. And they're not going to listen if people say, you are a race, you know, I agree with you. I agree that booing, taking the knee is a racist act, but we're not going to reach those people if you just say you are a racist, you're not listening, end.
We're not going to reach them anyway, Max. These are people that are actively saying, without saying, I don't want to understand why you're doing what you're doing. Because for me, again, if a man is telling you that I'm doing this act for this reason, and you are outright countering that by saying, well, no, you're not. Whether you believe that or not is up to you, but don't tell me what I'm not doing. Do you know what I mean? So these are people that I don't think can be reached anyway. I hear what Ian Wright is saying there, but my focus, and this is kind of beyond football, is focusing on the youth. I think we need to focus more on, you know, making sure we're growing up a generation of young people who are caring, who are outward looking, who are, I hate the word tolerant, but I think you know what I mean, rather than focusing on the 58-year-old man who's not going to change his mind. He's not changing his mind. He believes what he believes. He's entrenched in it, and he's gonna think how he thinks. So I'm not sure those people can be reached, personally.
The reach thing, in a way, is kind of precisely what's behind Gareth Southgate's message, isn't it? If someone can reach fans of England, in theory, it's the England manager. And in theory, it's someone with a very clear message which says, okay, if you're saying this is why we're doing it, let me spell this out very clearly. This is why we're doing it. And from that point on, if that still doesn't reach you, then yeah, then you get to this point, as you say, where you say, well, if that's not reaching, well, perhaps nothing will.
I completely agree. I think the education piece has been done now. It's been done by Southgate. It's been done by numerous players, Jordan Henderson. It's been done by everybody now. It's gone beyond that. So people now know why they're doing it and they're choosing to come up with booing. So, yeah, I think we've gone past that point now.
All right. Sid, thanks for your time, mate.
Pleasure. Cheerio.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. We'll chat to him throughout the tournament. He's a busy man, but he loves nothing more than
when you call me, Max.
You love it when you send me like a 7-minute WhatsApp voice message saying, here's why I can't do that. I'm in a car. I've got 17 games to go to. What you should have done, Sid, is worked out a way where your whole career can be football-based, but you never have to be more than 10 minutes from your house.
Or even 10 minutes from your living room, or 10 meters from your living room. Yeah.
I'd like a house big enough where it'd take me 10 minutes to get from my spare room to my living room. That doesn't happen at the moment. Cheers, Sid.
Cheerio. See you later, everyone.
We'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. William says, £20 million fine shared between the richest six clubs in the country. That's bullshit, right? They've agreed to pay £22 million to grassroots causes. In future, each club agreeing to enter a competition without the consent of the league would pay a fine of £25 million and receive a 30-point deduction. Mark, it does seem paltry as a fine. Paul McInnes has written an interesting piece in the paper today saying that, you know, they had to be careful and they had to have sort of negotiate with the six clubs because those six clubs are incredibly important to the Premier League.
They are important, but I mean, I was out at lunch yesterday and somebody sort of said, oh, 20 million fine each. They've got away with that.
What did you have, Mark, for lunch? What did you have just out of
interest? Good question.
I had calamari to start, followed by mussels and frites for lunch.
Less meaty than I was expecting.
Well, no, I like fish as well. I do like fish. We all thought it was 20 million each and felt that the clubs had maybe got away with that and were quite satisfied. And then somebody kind of checked it and said, no, there's 20 million between all of them. It doesn't feel like enough for, you know, threatening to effectively destroy the whole of English football. I suppose there is more of a deterrent there now, and there does have to be that balance to some extent, but I feel like it should have been more. I'm not sure what actually good you would do with that money. And I suppose got questions as to where it would end up anyway, but I don't think it was enough, no.
Danny says, is Spurs sacking a manager and then hiring the manager that got sacked to bring in the sacked Spurs manager the most Spursy thing in the world, or just a confusing riddle? Ben says, why is Daniel Levy determined to destroy Tottenham Hotspur? Joseph, slightly more reserved, is Paulo Fonseca a good appointment for Spurs? I'm a Tottenham fan. I'm unsure whether I should be happy or sad. I know, Jordan, as an Arsenal fan, you're delighted with the maelstrom at Spurs. Mark, you probably of all of us have the best knowledge of Fonseca, what he's done and what he hasn't done. Successful in Ukraine, did okay in Portugal, didn't really work at Roma, or did okay at Roma.
I suppose that's the thing. It's like, okay. I think the football at Roma was good. It was fun to watch. Plays out from the back. Roma were a team that you would like to watch, I suppose, on a weekend. But I don't think he sort of, there were a lot of teams in Italy that have changed manager this summer, and he wasn't in the running for any of them jobs. You know, I think it was Fenerbahce was somewhere where they thought he was maybe going until this late interest from Tottenham. I think he's somebody that would love to work for Tottenham. I think he sort of, it's a good move for him, probably better than what it is for Tottenham appointing him. And I think that's where the concern comes from the Spurs fans, is that this feels like quite a cheap option, and therefore, you know, what does that say about the potential, what's going to happen in the summer? They already talked that, you know, Conte had certain demands that Tottenham were unable to match, and I don't have a problem with that, because, you know, it's really difficult to say Tottenham should do whatever Antonio Conte wants. I mean, you don't know what it was he actually wanted. So I think you have to work within a, you know, a framework and a structure and a budget. But when you started off at Nagelsmann and you're thinking maybe Hansi Flick, and then you're going Brendan Rodgers, Erik ten Hag, Pochettino, Antonio Conte, I'm not quite sure how you then end up at somebody that's not at that level and probably never will be at that level. It's not to say that he'll do a bad job. You know, it's really difficult to say, and a lot will depend on what happens in the transfer market. But I think Tottenham fans are really angry at the whole process, the fact that they sacked Mourinho and had no plan what they were supposed to do next. And the new sporting director, Paratici, just looks like he's got kind of gone straight to what he knows in Serie A rather than maybe having a right look round and just appointed a cheap option, I suppose.
I'm not going to completely laugh at Spurs, because we've seen in the past where, you know, clubs have appointed managers that are maybe underwhelming and ended up being, you know, under the radar, done a really, really good job. I mean, Pochettino is an example of that when he was appointed at Spurs. I remember the outcry when they, when Southampton lost Pochettino to Spurs, and Spurs were like, who's this guy? Why are we taking their manager? And he did a good job there. But it is interesting about Mark's point being the perceived cheaper option, because the whole project of what Spurs and Levy are trying to sell is that we're going to be a global sporting brand. We've got the big new stadium, the NFL. We've got one of the best strikers in the world. And Mourinho, that appointment felt like it was working within the overall brand of where Spurs trying to go. And this kind of goes against that. And although I think Conte would have been a bad signing in terms of clashing of demands and personalities at Spurs, at least it would have fitted into the idea that we're trying to be a world club. We've got a top manager, a top striker, and a top stadium. This kind of goes against that. So I wonder how now the Spurs sell it to the Spurs fans that we are still trying to compete with the Cities and the Chelseas and the Uniteds. This appointment doesn't seem to do that.
I suppose it's a good point about the global brand, because that is upsetting quite a lot of Spurs fans at the moment, that they feel like Enoch and therefore Daniel Levy are only really in it to try to create some NFL franchise, really, and that Tottenham becomes just a sort of small part. And I'm not saying that that's true, but when you're charging some of the most expensive tickets in the world to go and watch football, and, you know, they're right at the top of the Premier League, I think that, you know, just if you are what you are and you can't sort of go into that market and say, look, we, you know, we've pushed for the Champions League, now we've got to live a sort of a more sustainable life, the fans wouldn't like that. But at least you're honest with them, and you then say, well, you know, we'll charge ticket prices at a level that we're going to be. I don't think you can charge you know, Champions League prices and your aim looks to be sort of Europa Conference League. You know, that disconnect is really strong at the moment between owners and fans, and Daniel Levy's not going to enjoy his time at that stadium if fans are allowed in next season if things don't start well.
Worth saying that Spurs are only in advanced talks with Paulo Fonseca. As far as I can tell, they've been in advanced talks with every one of those managers. So, you know, it may not stop at Fonseca, you know. You know, at some point, Steve Evans will be having advanced talks. Everton are in for Rafa Benitez, Marcus. That's fun, isn't it? I mean, how great would we see Everton to see Benitez at Goodison next to Duncan Ferguson winning at Anfield?
Yeah, that's painful. That's going to be a really tough one to watch as a Liverpool fan. Listen, I think it's not a bad appointment. I think it's very disappointing Ancelotti left. I think that probably hit them for six. I didn't see that one coming. But I think Benitez will do well at Everton, given the budget they've got, etc. I think he'll do well.
Yeah, sensible. Oh, you wonder if Spurs would be better off with Benitez than Fonseca? Who knows? Celtic have appointed Ange Postecoglou. I am the sort of one-man PR mission for Postecoglou with all my Australian contacts. He's a brilliant manager. He did incredible things in the A-League. It is still a football league, even if he did brilliantly in Japan, which is you're sneering at me, Mark. He did brilliantly in Japan, well with the...
Oh, No, sorry, I was just smiling ahead because, I mean, you know, there's so much negativity around that appointment, and it feels a little bit, it feels unjustified at this moment, you know. Like, you're right, you know, if you're successful in Australia, it doesn't mean, like, why would that mean you can't be successful in Scotland, for instance?
Listen, Alan Fletcher, Dr. Carl Kennedy, successful in Australia, even more successful in the UK. So you never know. The same could happen with Ange. I hope he does brilliantly. Grant says, can Jordan Jarrett Bryan shine any light on why Buendia would choose to play for Dean Smith rather than Mikel Arteta?
Ooh. Oh, man. The answer is no, but I'd acknowledge it's a massive own goal. It's a huge embarrassment for Arsenal. You know, that players coming from the Championship are picking Aston Villa of all teams over Arsenal. I think Arsenal have tried to, well, the fan base have spun this as, oh no, we didn't really want him anyway, and there are other better attackers we can get out there. I think he's a really good player. I think he could have done a really, really good job. And there's nothing wrong with missing out on a player, but I think when a player now is picking a team that is perceived to be not as big as you, over you, that I think says quite a lot. And yeah, the fact that it's Villa does burn me personally a little bit as well.
Pete says, how is Marcus's course that he was doing going? When will he be qualified to take over the running of FIFA?
give me 6 months and I'll do it. No, 6 months. So September, just after September, I'll be finished with it.
Okay. And that qualifies you. What's the qualification reminders?
Oh, it's the master's in sports directorship. So it's all around the role of a sporting director.
Okay. And your plan is what?
One day to be a sporting director, as high as possible I can go, mate. Yeah, that's the plan.
And appoint Paolo Fonseca.
Well, I was going to say, can I get the job? And then Max can be like the star striker and Mark can be like the chief scout of Europe and find the best players across Europe. We've got it all here, you know?
You've got it all here. Yeah, exactly. We're sorted.
I think my left knee won't, I've got no cartilage. It'd be a hard signing to sell to the club.
Oh, dear.
Gareth says, as a fellow butter addict, what is Mark Langdon's favourite method of delivery to the stomach? Personally, malt loaf is my number one choice. The amount of butter you can get in your system when you slice up one of those bad boys is immense.
You know, I go for the crumpet. You know, I just think that the hotness of the crumpet and the way the butter just melts on it is absolutely beautiful, yeah. You see, you're basically having the crumpet with butter. You know, butter is the main part of that, and the crumpet just sort of is there.
And you can sort of double spread like Nigella does with toast. You can spread it, sink through, spread it again. Can't you?
Exactly, and you can also have a bit on the side if you want to dip. If you say this, not that I've ever done. I mean,
absolutely, you can't butter three ways. That's like MasterChef, isn't it? Mark is doing butter three ways on a bed of crumpets. Bipinder Singh writes an email. Hi, Max, Barry, and team. I'm writing for the first time from Canada. I've been listening for just over 2 years. You helped me survive the lockdown. Very kind of you to say. I've not had an accident in a car, kitchen, or any other way while listening to the podcast. I was disappointed to see Barry's picture when the podcast icon was updated. I assumed that Barry, because of his voice, would be like Ian Wright, an older Marlon Brando in The Godfather, or Morgan Freeman in Shawshank, a wise, weathered man letting kids play around him, just waiting to slowly rise from the rocking chair and smack them around and beat sense into them. However, when I saw Barry's picture, my imagination was shattered. He seemed like a caring older brother, a serious Jack Black or Jonah Hill. I'm afraid to look up how Philippe Auclair looks in real life. I imagine David Suchet as Hercule Poirot or Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau. Definitely a moustache. We will say nothing and leave it all to the imagination, I would say. But thank you for email. We welcome all emails, footballweekly@theguardian.com. That'll do for today. Looking forward to seeing 2,000 or something come into the live show anymore. That seems quite a lot of people, given how sunny it is. But thank you. We try and be entertaining. We're back on Friday night for the first Euros pod. But in the meantime, Marcus Bean, thank you very much.
Cheers, Max.
Jordan Jarrett Bryan, thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Mark Langdon, thank you.
Thank you.
See you on Friday night.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.